It's time for Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, Greg Leahy.
Hello.
James Jones.
Hi.
And returning from the Deep South with his acquired southern drawl is John Lindemann.
I'm back again for your listening pleasure.
John, how are the beaches in Alabama?
They're nice, actually. Mm-hmm. Even though there is still the slightest hint of oil underneath the surface of the sand, I can confirm that. I was digging for shells. Yeah, underneath, and you put your hands in there in the sand to bring up some shells, and you got little streaks of oil on you. So
wow.
But it's just all underneath the sand. You don't have to worry about it. It's like it's not even there. Just go and fill up at BP, and everything is cool. Everything is fine.
Uh-oh. John's on the take.
They pay you off when you enter town. You go through this checkpoint, and they hand you hush money. So, let's talk about video games. John, did you play anything while you were on vacation?
Not much. Still playing through Chrono Trigger. I'm at the point where I've gotten the epic to the point where it can fly and travel through time. So, I'm in full kind of dick around mode. Like, you can go anywhere you want. So, you know, I'm doing little like side quests here. I got the golden hammer for some reptites, which I thought would give me something cooler, but instead they just gave me 100,000 gold.
Isn't that in some of the new bonus content?
That sounds like
the Lost Sanctum stuff. So you're not going to get anything that cool from that.
Yeah,
it's very superfluous kind of stuff that got put into the DS version.
Yeah, most of the side quests are more productive than that.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean it was okay because you know I was able to raise up some of my characters. I chose not to kill Magus. I had him join my party. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
He's kind of physically weak, and he doesn't have any, like, combo techs.
Yeah.
But his magic is so strong.
And he's got all the types.
Yep.
Represented, yeah. That's the main thing.
He's very useful.
So, yeah, I'm pretty much just kind of playing around with that and, you know, travel through the different eras and see what more I can do, and then I'll probably hop back onto the main storyline, wherever that might take me.
No, I don't want to be too leading here, but you're familiar with the whole Final Fantasy VII Aeris situation.
Yes.
Chrono Trigger's not like that.
Okay.
Spoilers! You're spoiling this ancient game!
Well, Chrono Trigger is so much more lighthearted than Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, and I was kind of thinking, as I've been playing through it, I've been kind of thinking how this ranks, because to a lot of people, it's the best RPG ever, sort of thing. And, you know, and obviously, I probably would have felt more strongly one way or the other if I would have played it when it actually came out. Mm-hmm. But I mean, to me, like right now, just being where I am in the game, like I think it's really, really good. But Final Fantasy III/6 to me is better just because to me it feels like it's less lighthearted. And I tend to like games with kind of like a darker edge to them sort of thing.
John's an edgy adult gamer.
Well, Chrono Trigger feels...
in the mid-90s, yeah.
Well, it feels more Dragon Quest-y to me than Final Fantasy-ish.
Well, it has the character design, certainly, of Dragon Quest, but I think...
But even the tone of it, though.
Yeah, you're right. It has more of that. And I think it was this dream collaboration between Square and Enix when they were still separate companies. Mm-hmm. And I think the appeal of Chrono Trigger is that it has... The gameplay systems are more Final Fantasy-like than they are Dragon Quest, so they feel more modern and a little bit more fluid, you know?
Yeah.
But then it also does things that almost no game did around that time, like the fact that you can see the enemies on the map, so there's no so-called random battles, you know? Mm-hmm. You can dodge enemies and things like that. That was pretty special at the time, you know? And it's still special for JRPGs to some extent.
Yep.
Well, I'm glad you're liking it. You know, it was just announced today that it's coming out in the U.S. on Virtual Console on Monday, so actually the day after this podcast launches.
Dun, dun,
by the time you hear this, it will probably be available worldwide because it's already out in Europe and it's been out in Japan for a while.
No. It's just been confirmed for Europe. It's not out yet. I would anticipate it's probably going to be pretty soon, next couple of weeks. But it looks like the States will be getting it first, which is weird because, of course, it's leapfrogging FF3/6.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad Chrono Trigger's coming out. I want people to play it, but... For me personally, since I have the DS version and it's very good, I am much more excited about FF6 because I don't think I'm going to buy Chrono Trigger on Virtual Console.
Yeah, I get kind of a kick out of it because for once in the entire lifetime of me being involved with Chrono Trigger, I'm actually ahead of the curve a little bit rather than ruthlessly like decades behind the curve. So I'm actually playing it before it gets to Virtual Console.
There you go.
Well, certainly this is a good opportunity to remind people. Of course, we don't have to remind you that Chrono Trigger is a great game, and we've been talking about it for months.
Yes.
And years, really. And I've said before, it's probably my favorite game of all time, but I do want to tell people, because it's coming to Virtual Console, and it's going to be very cheap and very easy to get, you know, and I hope a lot of people are going to consider playing it. One thing I do want to say is that I think this is probably the quintessential RPG for people who don't normally play RPGs. Mm-hmm. Because it is so polished, it's a fairly easy game, it's very nice to get into, it avoids a lot of the sort of stereotypical claptrap of Japanese RPGs. It's certainly much less melodramatic than any Final Fantasy game. It's absolutely beautiful, the presentation is superb, it's short. Believe it or not, it is like under 20 hours. It's
if
a short,
you can believe it from this show, which
it's
you
quite
shouldn't.
Short for the RPG genre. Mm-hmm. So I really think that if you're one of the many people who basically played, let's say, Super Mario RPG back in the 90s, and you haven't really played any RPGs since then, or you've tried some you didn't like them, I bet you will love Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, music is also fantastic. Let me say.
Oh yeah. It's actually a little better. It should be better on Virtual Console, I think.
I think it is. The DS is admirably close, but it's not quite there.
Yeah. Yeah, you get the original Sony chip music on the Virtual Console. Or the emulated Sony chip.
Yeah.
But Virtual Console is actually well-renowned for its highly authentic sound emulation. I mean, even like, say, on Genesis, a lot of people think most Genesis emulators on other systems sound really, really inauthentic. And I think on Virtual Console, it's pretty much considered to be one of the best Genesis emulators, especially in the audio realm. So that's very good news that it's coming out, and I hope Final Fantasy III is not far behind, because I want you to play that. James, do you have anything this week?
Maybe I can briefly speak of very, 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 very short time with the Ghost Recon 3DS game.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably already aware it's a top-down, turn-based strategy game with tacked-on 3D. You know, I've only played for maybe 20 minutes. You control a character, you move them along a grid, and give them orders to attack. It's very Fire Emblem-y. I mean, really, it's a Fire Emblem game with guns.
Have you had any technical problems with it yet?
I've only played it for 20 minutes, so no.
Oh.
Give it another 10. Yeah.
I would be pretty bad if such a small sample.
No, apparently the technical problems tend to hit towards the very end of the game.
Oh, lovely.
I don't know. I can't really speak much of it yet. I mean, it feels like Intelligent Systems made it.
That's high praise.
Well, I mean, it's more like they took Intelligent Systems game design and just said, copy that.
Not a bad strategy.
I'm not sure it's praise yet so much as it is like, wow, they really went full on do that kind of philosophy here, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So if you really need a Fire Emblem game, well, or an advanced, well, it's Advance Wars, but you don't get to do any resource allocation.
Hmm.
And you have a 3DS game and you're willing to let your game crash on you every so often, as this game is apparently want to do.
There is an unlocalized DS Fire Emblem, isn't there?
Yeah.
At least one.
That came out after the Shadow Dragon one that came over. I guess there's quite a few games that aren't going to make the cut now. I mean, it doesn't look like Last Window's ever going to get to the States.
No, but I mean, at least you can get that in English.
Yeah, you can import that one.
I've heard good things about Last Window. That's the Hotel Dusk sequel, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get some of those late games, like Soul to Robo at E3. As sort of like on the press releases that they don't even talk about.
I'd be surprised, but that would be a nice...
Well, I could see it like showing up in the press kit.
Hmm.
What game? There was a game on there last year in the press kit that was in the footnote they didn't even mention during the event.
There's always some.
There was Wario one year. Wario Land Shake. It was...
Oh, yeah.
Wario Land and Rhythm Heaven, which, you know, they ended up marketing quite heavily, but
yeah.
They didn't play up the significance of it that particular E3 at all.
Yeah, I mean... It's always kind of, this kind of off on a tangent, but I don't need to talk about effort. I can do that. It's kind of interesting if you're on in the field team when you get back to the media room and you're communicating with the home team for the first time since the show started, and they've been pouring through this press kit, and they're talking about games you have no idea what the hell they're talking about. It's in the press kit, man. What do you mean it's in the press kit? Are you full of crap? And then you look at it, and they're like, damn, there really is a game in there.
Yeah, we try to – it's different because – with E3, we used to have so many people there that we'd have at least half the crew going through the press kit, and you know, and they'd be syncing up with the home team as well. But now we tend to have smaller groups at the actual show.
Right.
And so we're covering more of the things that were actually there, playable or visible, viewable.
Right. And it's even more, probably more so the last couple of years, because Nintendo has adopted a philosophy of, and I assume they intend to continue it this year, of having things playable at their press event.
Mm-hmm.
And
I hope they do this year.
That's probably the best way to play the games because the line's a hell of a lot shorter.
James, I seem to recall you being the very first person to play Skyward Sword and someone doing some kind of like video interview with you while you were doing it.
It was the year before I was the first person to play New Super Mario Brothers. We also had the first impressions online. However, I was one of the first people to play Skyward Sword, and yeah, I did get interviewed by a media outlet, and I had a picture in a bunch of weird newspapers picked up by the AP, like the Hindu Times of India. I mean, it was bizarro land.
You should put that on your resume.
There we go. Featured Hindu Times.
I've started having my E3 dreams, my annual E3 dream, pre-E3 dreams.
Oh, I mean, we're what?
Like what?
I dream that I'm at E3.
We're what?
I've been doing this for
now?
A decade, man. Seriously, every year it comes.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming at me like a freight train at this point.
Yep.
I've crossed the point from being like, yeah, I'm kind of excited to the point thinking, oh god, why did I sign up for this again? What am I doing?
Because it's awesome. If I get to go this year, it'll be my 11th E3, and I'm really trying to go because I love it so much.
There's going to be a moment where I'm standing in the middle of South Hall, and there's going to be this cacophony of sound. I'll be like, oh, God. Why am I here?
You know, for me, more than anything, E3 is a chance to hang out with friends that I really don't even get to be around otherwise. And PAX East has started to fill that a little bit for me, but it's usually a different set of people. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of it. And there's so many stories. There's so many crazy things that happen at E3 that we don't write about because it doesn't make sense to. But, I mean, like the whole coleslaw thing. I mean, there's so many amazing stories.
That's disgusting.
The thing is, I mean, and that's just it. I mean, everything at E3 is so much more epic than anything at PAX East.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. No
I mean,
doubt.
Just completely, just everything is over the top, totally ridiculous. Yeah. Everything that happens there is an event.
Yeah, I mean, PAX East, you might get to go see parts of Boston. E3, you don't leave the convention center.
Yeah.
Unless it's to go walk to the sketchiest part of LA to go to a press event, because Ubisoft and EA picked this neighborhood to do it in.
Yep.
It's in the, with the jewelry district or
something. Yeah, the jewelry district, which is more like the bootleg Pokemon game district.
The camera shops with the counterfeit video games in the window, those are fun.
Oh, those are RFN prizes for the future, I'm telling you now.
Yeah.
Who wants Pokemon Black Diamond Edition?
Was that there last year?
Yes.
Did we see that? That's
amazing. I pointed it out and I was like, Carly, we need to go buy that right now.
Black Diamond. Wow.
We're late for the Ubisoft event. I don't care.
I think Michael Jai White's in that one. Hey, so speaking of E3, if I get to go, I'll have to take time off of work because I'm starting a new job on Monday right after the show comes
out.
Sweet.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm excited because let me tell you, this is how I know that that I'm ready to start working is because I played 5 distinct video games last week, not including stuff like Portal 2, which I started replaying. So very quickly, I'll say that I finally finished Radiant Historia. 65 hours was my final mark.
That's a long time.
As I told James, I love the game. I really do, and I recommend it, but the end is poorly paced because the last few hours of that game is just an endless boss rush, basically. And yes, you can save in between bosses. You can go heal. You can even go do side stuff, but if you're like, I mean, at this point, I'm ready to finish this, you know. I've done plenty of side stuff, and I'm like, okay, I just want to finish the story at this point. In order to do that, I think I had to play through 7 or 8 bosses in a row with really nothing in between except some people talking.
Wow.
So I felt like the game is very well-paced otherwise. It starts a little bit slowly, but for the chunk, you know, the largest chunk of the game, it's very well put together and it's nicely kind of laid out there, and it has you, there's a lot of variety, there's flipping back and forth between timelines, and it gets at the end and they're like, man, we got to wrap this up, but how do we do it? Let's make you fight five bosses that you already beat earlier in the game, except now they're stronger.
Much stronger.
And then we're going to have you fight this one guy three different times.
Oh, that guy's an asshole, too.
So...
I mean, how long does that take you?
Well, that one boss battle takes about 50 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. The final battle is really a slog. But, I mean, just this chain of bosses with all the dialogue in between is multiple hours long. I mean, it's like five... It took me like 5 hours just to get through that final chunk of it, so...
And you can save in between them, right?
Oh,
right.
Yeah, you can, but it's just like, if you want to finish the game, you got to keep pushing through it.
Yeah, that, for me, the most offensive part of that was that final boss, because I believe I sent an email right after I beat it to the people in this conversation saying, holy God, what was that?
Yeah. It's a war of attrition. It really is.
I think
is.
I started it at like 11:30 thinking, yeah, I can do this before I go to bed, and then I ended up going to bed late, like really late, because the stupid thing just wouldn't die.
The thing that disturbs me about you saying this, James, is that to me, every RPG final battle I've ever played is ridiculously overwrought.
Pretty much. I mean, the story wraps up pretty well, and I think the actual ending, after all the fighting's over, the actual ending of the game is pretty nice. It's a good way to wrap everything up, but just the way that the gameplay is handled at the end there, I have reservations.
I like that the ending is dynamic based on what quests you've completed. So, you know, there are some quests where you'll see different pieces of the whole ending.
Sure.
I ended up going through all of it and seeing all of the endings, and that's a really long freaking ending. Because it's got to like wrap up with every minor character. It's like, all right, now we're going to go visit these guys. I'm like, oh God, I forgot about them.
Yeah. Does it have a big spinning mask if you haven't wrapped up that side quest that blocks out the visuals?
It just skips it, and you're like, oh, okay, well, then I don't have to worry about them. And then it cuts the next guy, like, oh God, these guys? Jeez.
Yeah, so I also finished Mega Man Legends 2, which only took me 14 hours, thank goodness.
That's a pretty short game, considering.
Yeah, it was shorter than I thought it would be. I like it overall. You know, I'm glad I played through it. I mainly did it as research for the third game that's coming to 3DS, but I have to say, at some point about three-fourths of the way through the story, once I found all four of the keys... They're kind of the boondoggles or the MacGuffins that you're going after. They're like the crystals in Link to the Past or whatever. Once you get the four keys, the story begins to unravel in the worst way. And it became so nonsensical and incomprehensible that I just started pressing start to skip the cutscenes, which you really should not do in an RPG. I mean, it shouldn't come to that. But I'm watching it, and my mouth is open. I'm like, I just had no idea what was going on. It made no sense. And I found that it was difficult to hear the dialogue during a lot of the scenes, because there are some scenes where the people talk to you and they come up in text bubbles and you advance it manually, and that's fine. But then sometimes they play cutscenes, which are just people standing around talking to each other, but there's no subtitles or anything. And it seems like the voices are mixed a lot lower than the background music and the rest of the game. And so I found it actually kind of hard to understand what they were saying sometimes. And there's a lot of things where they're trying to match up to the lip syncing of the Japanese version. So the script is this weird kind of, you know, like if you watch a lot of overdubbed anime, how people speak in this weird meter so that they can match up the English words with the Japanese voice movement.
That never goes well.
I mean, they do an okay job with it, I guess, but it's just weird. So anyway, I just, yeah, and just the plot of it, it goes completely nuts towards the end.
I mean, I think that's kind of what they were going for, but they sort of hit it out of the park, and then,
And then out of the stratosphere.
I was thinking, like, they hit it out of the park and then gave a concession worker a concussion.
Yeah.
Because it's supposed to be goofy and crazy, but it's like balls-to-the-wall madness at some point.
Well, I mean, the premise of the game is neat. It's very Skies of Arcadia, you know. It's like the, you know, Mega Man and Roll are basically...
Well, Skies of Arcadia is very it.
Well, sure, yeah, but... You know, Mega Man and Roll are treasure hunters, and they're flying around on their airship, and they're seeking the Motherlode, the ultimate hidden treasure, and they're trying to find out some things about Roll's family, and all of that stuff just seems to be thrown out by the end of the game. Like, it's like, oh, all that stuff's boring, we're gonna take on this completely other crazy end of the world type scenario, and you end up going to another planet or some shit. It's just like, just the ending seems to have nothing to do with the beginning. They just throw it away.
Legends 1, aka 64, is not nearly as batshit crazy as 2.
I just wonder where that leaves them with the third one, because I don't feel like I have any grasp on what the story of the third game could be.
It doesn't appear they're particularly concerned with the narrative of 2.
I'm kind of glad, because I...
It looks more like they're just saying, well, it's set in the same world.
Yeah, like the way 2 ends, I would kind of hope that they just sort of
there's
start
like
fresh.
Leprechauns flying in space. And-
Leprechaun 4, Leprechaun in space.
There you go.
Terrible.
There you go. But I mean, there kind of already was a pseudo sequel to these games anyway in the Tron Bone game.
Well, that came out between 1 and 2.
Oh, it's
like a side game.
Yeah, it's nuts too.
Yeah, I would not play that because Tron Bone is the most irritating character I've ever seen. I cannot listen to her speak, seriously.
The Bond clan is pretty much responsible for about 80% of the insanity of the Mega Man Legends franchise.
Yeah.
And then they made a game starring them, and it's pretty much 14 hours of you going, this sounds like an awful idea.
Yeah. It's like Tingle. It's like Tingle's, you know, Rupee Adventure or whatever.
Rosie Rupee Land.
Yes. Yeah. I must have that game. Yeah. It's really hard to get now, apparently.
And speaking of unlocalized DS games, there is the second one, the adventure style game, ripening Tingle's Balloon Trip of Love.
Oh god!
What does that even mean?
It's something to do with his quote unquote maturation.
Oh dear!
He's a grown man.
Prequel.
Oh, it's so.
We don't know.
Hey, so I also started playing Dragon Quest VI, but I'm still pretty early in that. I should have more to say about it next week. One thing I did notice right off the bat is that it has some weird similarities to Dragon Quest IX. So I think if you're a big fan of 9 and you're thinking about checking out one of the earlier Dragon Quest games that they've remade for DS, 6 seems like it might be maybe the easiest starting off point, because you play as characters who are... let's say, ethereal in certain portions of the game. So you know how Dragon Quest IX, it starts off and you're this angel, basically, and you're helping people solve their problems, and they can't really see you, and you can't really talk to them, you can just overhear them. There's some of that in the early parts of Dragon Quest VI, although it seems to be for somewhat different reasons, but it ends up playing out in a similar way. And there also seems to be the same kind of a job system, because they've mentioned the All Trades Abbey, although I can't use it yet where I am, but it's in the game too, and that's not in Dragon Quest 4 or 5. So it seems that this might be the closest one. Of course, then again, if you played like 100 hours of Dragon Quest 9, you might want something that's different, in which case I'd recommend 4. But anyway, I'm looking forward to playing more of that. It seems to be pretty good so far. The main things I wanted to talk about, fourth off, Valkyria Chronicles, which I think I bought this in January for like $10 on Amazon. I still hadn't played it. I finally got it in the PS3 and I put some time into it. I'm in the fourth chapter now. I don't know how many there are, but I feel bad for waiting this long to play it because it's kind of amazing. It's one of the best looking video games I've ever seen. And this game, it's 4 years old now, I think. It's about 4 years old. And I think it looks better than just about anything coming out this year on PS3 or on any system. And I think it helps that it has this very whimsical art style. I mean, it's the only things I can really compare it to are Wind Waker and Okami. Because, like Wind Waker, it looks like this living cartoon, basically, in a way that other games, you know, so-called cel-shaded games, don't. So I think it very much ties in with Wind Waker in that way, and also the wind seems to always be blowing in this setting of the game. And that really adds a lot of life to the character models and to what's happening on the screen. But then it also has this soft watercolor shading and this sort of parchment filter over it, because it's made to look like it's basically picture panels in a history book. So there's this sort of white frame around the edge of the screen, and there's this paper-like filter over it that looks a lot like Okami, even though the actual art style is very different from that. It's not as, it's not like ancient Japanese looking or anything like that. Now, James, I know you don't have a PS3, but you would absolutely adore this game. You really would. It's totally up your alley, because it's a strategy RPG with a very interesting story. Even though it looks like this living cartoon, and it has this very bright tone to it. The characters are generally pretty upbeat and sort of happy in that in that Japanese way. But the actual story is pretty grim. It's very clearly an allegory for World War II. These characters, they live in this small neutral country that's clearly based on Switzerland, and it's invaded by the seemingly evil empire to the east to mine its resources.
Right.
And they have, they have military conscription for all their youths, and so your character sort of gets swept up in this military conflict that he doesn't necessarily
understand. It's basically a good Operation Darkness.
I don't know that it's useful to reference Operation Darkness, but I'm glad you did.
It's the Xbox equivalent. It's nearly the same game, except one is terrible.
Yeah, it's not equivalent at all. I think Valkyria Chronicles is made by Overworks, the people who did Skies of Arcadia, and it's clear that they developed a spectacular game engine for it. I mean, I've never seen any other game that really looks quite like this, and it runs very fluidly. It does amazing things, and the art design is just incredible. And I was just thinking that it's really sad that they don't seem to have made any other PS3 games with this technology. You know, I think those same developers have moved on to continue the Valkyria series on PSP, but I mean, there's no way that this graphical style could translate that well to PSP. I'm sure it looks good. I'm sure it's a good looking PSP game, but the stuff this is doing, you can't even do it in standard definition. I mean, it looks so incredible.
Yeah, the sequel they made was a PSP game.
Yeah, and they've done a third one too on PSP that's in Japan. So, I'm glad that some people found this game, because it was kind of a bomb in America. The original it was, at least, but it's really good. I mean, it's an excellent strategy game too. It's really interesting because, I mean, it's sort of like Fire Emblem in 3D, like the GameCube and the Wii Fire Emblem games, but instead of it all being grid-based, your character basically has this action meter, and as you move around, it gets used up. So you can move anywhere you want, and you can shoot at any point in that. You can move, shoot, and then go back to your cover. And when you're controlling the character, it actually looks kind of like a very, very brightly colored Gears of War, in that it's third person, and there's all this cover all over the place. You're trying to line up and get a line of sight and shoot this guy and then get back to safety. But of course, it's all done turn-based, so there's not that much time pressure on you to get in and out of an area or anything like that. It's more about setting things up, but then, when you get ready to shoot a guy, you go into target mode and you put the cursor over him and you kind of aim on his body where you want to shoot it. And there are RPG elements too. You get experience and money, and you can upgrade things in between battles. It's a James game all over. And the fact that it's really beautiful and it has incredible music is just icing on the cake. John, you have your copy.
Yep.
That you haven't played, just like me. And I'm telling you, put it in for 20 minutes just to look at it, and you will want to play it
It was a game that I really had no plan on getting. And, I'd heard just amazing things. Reviews, and also, word of mouth. I had amazing word of mouth. And so, I mean, it was on sale like you said, it was on sale. I got mine for either $15 or $10 or something on Amazon.
I think mine was $10.
Yeah. I was like, at some point I will play this game. I will make a point of playing it.
Really?
Yes. Yes, James.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, you absolutely should. And Greg, I think you would probably like it too. So, I hope people will check out. I mean, obviously, I'm very late to the party, but I'm not the last. So,
well, that's up to John.
Well, John got to the party first, but then he immediately went in the bathroom and hit himself there.
Yeah, but it seems like more people still need to play Valkyria Chronicles, and I'm glad I finally got around to it. And I'm like, wow, why did I wait so long? It's incredible. It's really amazing. Actually, if you've seen the cutscenes that they have in Fire Emblem Path of Radiance or Radiant Dawn, mm-hmm. Valkyria Chronicles looks kind of like those cutscenes, but in real time.
Wow.
It's a little more watercolor looking. It's not, the colors aren't as bold, mm-hmm. but very similar, I think. And I remember when I first saw those cutscenes in Path of Radiance, I was blown away. Just a, I mean, I knew they were CG, but I was like, wow, I can't believe that looks so good.
Yep.
So this game is really kind of magical in terms of presentation, and the gameplay seems to be very, very solid as well. And finally, I want to mention an Xbox indie game that I played this week, and it blew me away. It's called Sequence, and it's only $3, which I guess is now the maximum price for indie games. For this game, $3 is a ludicrous price. I played it for over 10 hours this week, and the production quality, the production values that went into this game are insane. I felt like I feel like I stole it for $3. I really do, because it's so good. And it's all made, pretty much the entire game was made by this one guy who did the programming and the game design and the writing. And then he got one other person to do the artwork. And then the music is licensed from a couple of sort of internet DJ guys. One of them is named Ronald Jenkins. I don't know how well known he is, but his music is really good. And then the other guy's goes by the name of DJ Play School. And the music's really important because this is, it's essentially an RPG in the vein of, let's say, Puzzle Quest, because there's no exploration really. It's mainly a series of battles and menus in between. But instead of like playing Bejeweled for your battles, it's a rhythm game like DDR. And not just a ripoff of DDR, but it uses that, you know, the note highway coming down, this rhythm gameplay, very similar to Guitar Hero or Rock Band also. But it uses that, and then it develops this whole strategic, really interesting battle system around it. So you're doing that, but that's like the base mechanics of what you're doing. You're also juggling mana and HP and using different spells to do different things. And when you first see it, the battle system is a bit overwhelming because there are actually three different fields of notes or three different note highways that you can flip between at any time. And at any given time, it's possible to have notes coming down on all three. And so you actually have to choose which one to devote your attention to. So one of them is the defense, and any time the notes come down there, if you don't hit the notes when they get to the bottom, they will do damage to you. So you can do nothing and just take that damage, and sometimes that's the best thing to do. Actually, a lot of times it is. But if it's a really strong enemy or if you're almost dead, then you need to flip over there and actually hit those to protect yourself. And then there's another one where the notes come down and they just refill your mana if you hit them. So a lot of times you can leave those off. You can just avoid those if you don't need the mana, but if you're casting a lot of spells, you go over there to recharge. And the other one is your spell field, and anytime you cast a spell, which is how you attack, heal, etc., that's how you do all kinds of stuff in the battles. You choose your spell, you cast it, it uses up your mana, and then this note chart comes down representing that spell, and you have to hit all the notes in the spell to actually use it. So if you miss any, you fail the spell and you wasted your mana, which is really bad. So it's pretty easy at first. It's mainly a matter of you getting used to the interface and how to flip between the fields and just understand what's going on. As you get later in the game, it gets very challenging. And just you develop this weird capacity to juggle all this stuff and to look at the field and actually understand what's going on, even though it's very complex. There's a lot of stuff on the screen and there's a lot of things that you're trying to balance. And you're making all these decisions while playing Guitar Hero, essentially. So you can imagine all the strategic decision making and, you know, awareness, situational awareness that goes into playing like a really fast paced RPG, but now you're doing that while playing Guitar Hero at the same time. It's very, very challenging. And you can play it on the Xbox controller, which I started out doing, and that works. It's a little odd, but it's kind of like playing DDR on a controller, but you can do it. You can use a dance pad, which I don't have access to. I don't have any for 360, so I couldn't try that. Or you can use a guitar. And I ended up playing most of the game on a guitar. So I played through a 10-12 hour RPG on a plastic guitar, and I loved it.
Wow, that's crazy.
And it's not just the RPG gameplay is really good. The music is excellent. It's all like electronic. I would call it like chill out music. Mm-hmm. And it definitely holds up to repeat listenings, which is important because you're grinding through this RPG and you're hearing these songs over and over, which of course every RPG struggles with. You know, battle music is a big deal in RPG because you're going to hear it so much. And in this case, there are actually more than a dozen battle songs. So it's less repetitive than other RPGs, but you're listening to the music more because it actually affects how you play the game. Mm-hmm. So whether the song is slow or fast or really dense with notes, all of that plays into the difficulty of a particular battle. And it's just the artwork is excellent. The writing is amazingly good. It's really, really sharp, very witty, full of jokes, really good jokes that I actually laughed at. And then the whole thing is done with voice acting. There are a lot of characters. There's a lot of voice acting, and the voice acting is really good. And then I got to the end credits and found out that the main character is actually voiced by the guy who wrote the game.
Wow.
Which I was shocked because he sounds like a professional voice actor, like a really good one. It's like, holy shit, this is the programmer, and this is the guy who made the game. It's remarkable.
Isn't that the case for Conker? Wasn't that one someone from Rare?
Well, it's definitely someone from Rare, but I think it's actually the guy who designed the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rare's not really one to outsource much of anything, or they weren't at that time.
Yeah, certainly weren't.
But this is, I mean, as far as like a pet project or like a work of, you know, a work of love, it's amazing, but it's also an excellent game, and it's an insane value for what he's selling it for. And, you know, being an Xbox indie game, it's not getting much exposure. There aren't that many people talking about it. And I guess he's planning to release it on Steam pretty soon, which I think will be really good for him. I think he'll probably make a lot more money on that. But for me, of course, I have an Xbox, so I have access to it, but I think it works better as a console game because, you know, it's a lot easier for me to connect my controllers to that, and it's a game that I would want to play on my TV and not on a computer. So for me, I'm glad that it's available on Xbox, even though it may not be the best financial decision for this guy. But if you can only play it on Steam, I would say definitely keep an eye out for Sequence. It is a really impressive game and very unusual. It's just there's nothing else out there that's really quite like it, and the more I played it, the more I kind of fell in love with it. And I was like, I can't believe that one guy pretty much made this by himself, and it's this good, and it's this cheap. It's just kind of unbelievable. I mean, this is, I would say, better made, and there's a lot more to it than most of the games on Xbox Live Arcade that cost five times as much.
Well, I mean, this is one of the great things about the indie games on Xbox Live is the fact that is a game that never would have been made. Especially right now where, you know, music games are seen as kind of taking a nosedive, and also the fact that it's a music game and an RPG, which is one of the craziest kinds of mashups you can possibly have. It's a game that never would have been made by anybody in their right mind outside of somebody, some indie guy who really had not much to lose but time.
I mean, when WiiWare was first announced, I thought this is the kind of thing that we'd get on WiiWare, like the really crazy experimental games, and it hasn't really worked out that way.
No, you know, yeah, mostly publishers doing things that are too stupid to really merit actually being done.
Well, I mean, it's been said already that Nintendo, they do not want garage development on WiiWare.
Yeah, but
whatever they consider that to mean.
Oh, it means that you have to have basically some kind of business address.
You have to have a P.O. box, essentially.
No, I don't even think it can be a P.O. box. I think it has to be a business address.
Yep. Damn.
And this guy made this in his room, so this wouldn't have qualified. And plus, this game is hundreds of megabytes. I mean, it's got tons of high-quality music and voice acting. There's no way it would ever fit in WiiWare anyway. So there are numerous reasons for it, but I just think, you know, I think the premise of WiiWare, the original concept of it, was very promising, and then the actual restrictions on that turned out to be so limiting that it kind of missed the mark on what it was supposed to do. Anyway, Sequence is amazing. You really should check it out. Greg?
Well, I almost feel obliged to top off this RPG fest with a quick little update on Infinite Space now.
Nice.
I've been playing for about 6 hours, so it's quite a long way to go. I'm in the third chapter, and the Crowdhammer has been joined by the Gigonaut, which is named after the Pulitzer Prize winning editor of the Wall Street Journal, Paul Gigot, and the Raging Cajun Cruiser, named after who else but James Carville.
Sure, that guy from K Street, yeah.
How many ships do you end up getting, James?
I think the max you can haul around is 5, but towards the end of the game, you're selling and buying new ones.
Yeah.
So I started running out of names. So like a ship would replace one, and I would give it the name of its predecessor with a numeral at the end.
Oh, the NCC 1701-D.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So it was like I was naming mine after aquatic mammals based on their size. So I was on like blue whale number 8 because I was replacing carriers as fast as I could get new ones.
Oh, blue whale totally works though because of, you know, Final Fantasy.
I went through, I probably went through about 13 ships all told, which is a fair number of ships.
Greg's going to end up with the nation's best political team.
Yeah, yeah. Screw you, Blitzer. I'll argue with this.
Blitzer's a pretty good ship name, actually.
Yeah, but he's not. He's like a mouthpiece. That's that you don't get on my team if you're just, you know, a suit.
You have to be more than a talking head.
Yeah, exactly. He's a talking head, Blitzer. So no Blitzer, no Anderson Cooper Knot or whatever. That's not happening.
The tight t-shirt knot.
Come on. He's a journalist, man. He's a journalist. He's a legitimate journalist.
Would you take the Van Susteren? That works pretty well, doesn't it, for a ship name?
The Van Susteren is under attack.
It doesn't work for me in a military context. I'm sorry. I've also got another DS thing. I've got the next in the line of the student seminar games that was released after last week with the Tentai show. This week we have the exquisitely Japanese title of Pull Pull Pulpy. Yes.
Pull Pull Pulpy.
It's just...
It sounds like a dictator or like a UN general secretary or something.
It's like Cats Touch Yoshi if you can't think of very many syllables. So this one is quite a bit different than the Tentai show from the point of view that was visually pretty much like a flash game. And then all the content was in, you know, the layouts, you know, how the asteroids were attacking you and this high score challenges and all that. This, Pull Pull Pulpy, I'll keep saying that as many times as I can crowbar it into this discussion, P-cubed, has like a lot more kind of, you know, assets to it, you know, like it's more like a traditional kind of action game. And it's got quite a nice visual style. I mean, it's really like you're basically playing as this, I guess it's a bit like Ditto, you know, from Pokemon, this kind of jelly blob, except he looks a lot happier than Ditto. And, you know, he's in this sort of like a Yoshi's Island-y kind of happy pastel aesthetic, not quite the same kind of verve as something like Yoshi's Island. But, you know, it looks nice and it animates. The animation is very fluid. And I was quite impressed considering, you know, these are student-made game. You know, it certainly was a lot more sort of lively and impressive than the Tentai show. But this is actually a book form action game, and in this case the fact that it's dual screen doesn't really matter. It's just a touch screen game, but it's kind of the gameplay is very vertically oriented because you're kind of ascending these levels, so you know it makes sense to have it on in the book style. And so you're on these little planetoids, and what you can do is use the stylus to either trace around them so that this little ball of jelly kind of just oozes around, and then you can extend the stylus out so it kind of stretches this jelly character, and then if there's a planetoid nearby, he'll snap to that and stick to that, and you just kind of, you know, stretching out from each one to the next, collecting all these different little stars that are around. That's basically that determines what award you get at the end of the level, how many stars you get, and you're just climbing up these layouts until you get to the top. Now, it doesn't feel quite in gameplay terms like that fleshed out. I mean, it's obviously short, you know, which makes sense considering, as we've said before, you can't keep these games. They're gone once you switch your DS off because of the way this whole DS download thing works. But you have like 8 levels. You've got, I think it was 7 before the credits, then the 8th one. But it's only really the 8th one where you get a sense of what potential there is in the concept, because the first 7 are just so easy. You know, once you get to the 8th level, you're actually, you know, fitting into some tight gaps. There's quite a lot of obstacles. You've got some more gameplay ideas where you'll snap to these little sort of containers, which you can then use to like drag him out of and snap him, and he goes way, way to the other side of the screen. And you can use that. You have to use good timing on stuff like that to pick up some extra tricky stars and things. You know, that's where you think, oh, well, maybe this has got some mileage in it. But you only get that for one level at the very end. So it is a cool concept and, you know, another nice use of the touchscreen, but it definitely didn't bring as much to the table for me as the Tentai show did last week.
How can you say it didn't bring as much to the table with that kind of name?
Well, certainly in the naming stakes, it can't be beat. But it was just felt like, considering you're only going to have a few levels or whatever, it just like, it seemed like you've got what would be, the first world of like a bigger game. It's like okay to have like a whole world full of easy levels to settle you in, but if you've only got 8, then it feel like it should have been getting more difficult right in the middle so that you could show more of what is kind of capable within this game design. So, you know, maybe a little bit of a missed opportunity, but it's still fun. And now I have to move on to what I've been playing mostly for this week. So I picked up Mortal Kombat for the PS3. So I've been on a kind of it's been a real fighting game renaissance for me since Tatsunoko vs. Capcom, since I imported that. I mean, I'd probably between that and Killer Instinct, I played one non-Smash Brothers fighting game, which was Soul Calibur 2.
Wow. For the GameCube. That's kind of impressive in a weird, perverse way.
Yeah. I mean, that's how little I play. Like, on the Super Nintendo.
It's about how much I play them, yeah. Like one every 5 years, maybe.
On the Super Nintendo, I had Street Fighter 2, I had Mortal Kombat 2, and I had Killer Instinct. So it was a pretty small fraction of the absolutely ridiculous abundance of one-on-one fighting games that were on that system. Mm-hmm. But plenty, all the same, you know, three fundamentally similar games.
And Greg, how do you feel about Killer Instinct? Because this game has been shat upon lately by a lot of people. It seems like a lot of people are going back and revising history and saying Killer Instinct was a terrible fighting game.
It's tough. It's tough because I really haven't touched that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat 2, I think probably on a handful of occasions I would have whipped that out and played it with someone. And certainly Street Fighter, I've played like Street Fighter 2 Turbo on the Virtual Console. But it's with Killer Instinct, you know, I really have to go by how I felt at the time.
Right.
Which, you know, a lot of Killer Instinct was, you know, it was a lot of flash.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of it in the arcades, ostensibly anyway, was like, oh, it's the Ultra 64 tech in the arcades. You get to see it before it's going to be in your home. And, you know, it's all these like little particle effects when projectiles collide. And, you know, I mean, it was that
awesome.
Kind of game.
It looked awesome.
At the time, it looked very impressive. And the fact that they had a relatively faithful version on the Super Nintendo was a feat in itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I was thinking that a lot of those fighting games from that era have all sort of been reevaluated in the same way, though. I mean, with the exception of the Street Fighter games, which I guess they're held up because they were such technical fighters.
Yeah, but people are still really fond of, say, Mortal Kombat 2, which I think Killer Instinct is better than Mortal Kombat 2.
I do hear people, though, say that those games were more flash than substance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a crowded field back then.
It was.
Yeah, you know, for those sorts of games. So there were a lot of, especially, you know, the Western-made ones that tried to be gimmicky, if you like.
Like Pit Fighter.
Pit Fighter is horrible.
But Pit Fighter predates the craze, if you like.
Yeah, it's older, so it gets a little bit of a reprieve in that respect.
I mean, I remember being 8, 9 years old and playing Pit Fighter in the arcade and thinking, this sucks. Like, I want my 50 cents back for real. It was terrible. Never good. Pit Fighter was never good. Nobody ever liked it.
I mean, like I said, just on the Killer Instinct point from my recollection at the time, I enjoyed it a fair bit. I mean, it was a bit of a weird like mashup between Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat in a way,
mm-hmm.
because you did have your like finishing moves like Mortal Kombat. You had some characters that controlled like Mortal Kombat characters, like Spinal, the Skeleton Knight.
Yeah.
Had those tappy inputs like a Mortal Kombat character.
Yeah, forward, back, punch.
Yeah, whereas other characters controlled, you know, like Ryu and Ken or whatever, you know, so that it was weird. It didn't really have its own identity, but I enjoyed it well enough at the time. How much it really holds up under scrutiny is a whole other thing, and I did play Gold for the N64.
I owned KI Gold. That was one of my N64...
Gold!
It was like first Christmas of N64, yeah, and I got it. And that and Cruisin' USA. So I played a lot of Killer Instinct.
See, the Ultra 64 dream came true for Johnny. It certainly didn't come true for me.
Yeah. No, I like KI Gold. I don't know if it's better than Killer Instinct 2 in the arcade. You know, it was kind of this remix of Killer Instinct 1 and 2 for the home version, but I will say Killer Instinct was the only fighting game, and maybe it's because it's one of the few that I actually owned. I used to rent them back in the heyday times, but
right.
It was one of the few that I actually owned, along with Street Fighter 2 for Super Nintendo. And I think Killer Instinct was the only fighting game that I've ever really learned to do combos in, because the combo system made sense to me. It had this certain logic. There were certain moves you could do as an opener, and then there were certain moves that were linkers, and there were certain moves that you could do after that, and then there were certain moves you could link again, and there were certain finisher moves. So there was this system, and if you understood the basic grammar of how to do it, and you understood how to do three or four special moves for a character, you could create all these crazy combos. And they could be broken, of course. Cuckoo combo breaker! But if you knew how to do a combo, then you could I could do it pretty reliably, and it looked cool, and it was very effective. I mean, I was a Fulgore guy, mostly, but...
I like Fulgore.
I like his sound effects, too. I like to...
He's so weird. There's like a pig squealing run through a vocoder or something. for a mechanical knight. Very, very strange. Yep. But this new Mortal Kombat has a bit of a Killer Instinct feel in certain aspects, because there is more of an emphasis, or at least an explicit emphasis, on combos now. From the point of view that they're emphasizing more you're sort of using your basic attacks, the four face buttons on the PS3 controller, your punches and kicks. More emphasizing chaining those together in specific ways, especially if you can get someone in the air, juggle them, just chain together that damage when they're helpless like that. And if you actually go to the list on the menu, it'll give you a bunch of kind of suggested combos involving your basic attacks, and then you can kind of tack on special moves or open with special moves, however you kind of manage to work it. And there is, in fact, because the biggest kind of thing that they've added to this, because it is very much like going back to Mortal Kombat 1-3. That's pretty much the point, because it's gone in all sorts of weird directions since, hasn't it? Like, 3D fighting, arena kind of fighting games where you can move around each other. And
in the fourth game, everyone had weapons, so it makes sense to go before that.
It's very much the Street Fighter 4 model, predictably, which is here's the formula that everyone liked in the mid-90s, and we've made some additions to it, but essentially we're just bringing that back and giving it the big HD graphical kind of overhaul. Mm-hmm. But one of the things they've added is a super meter. And you've got what would come to be a very crucial thing in that is that I think if it takes like 2/3 of the meter to do, but you have got a combo breaker move. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, the whole combo thing is definitely woven in a lot more explicitly than it was before in like 2. I mean, I think 3 maybe had more of that kind of, I didn't really play much of 3.
Yeah, me neither.
But I mean, it's very well done, in short. I mean, as that kind of revival of something, I mean, first of all, on a single player level, it's got about as much content as you could ask for. Mm-hmm. From a fighting game, I mean, it's got like this story mode, which basically covers the same ground as 1-3, except it's an alternate history kind of thing, so they can futz with it as much as they want. But God, I mean, fighting game stories are just,
Yeah.
It's admirable what they've done.
No, it's not.
It's slick. The execution is slick, and like the way that, for instance, the cutscenes will play and then just segue relatively seamlessly into the actual fight, and there's no loading, and it's done very well on a technical level, but in the end it's like, do I care about the story? No.
Yeah. And the thing is, the characters are so ridiculous most of the time.
Oh, of course.
The thing is, they design the characters first and then wrap some horrible story around them.
What we got to remember as well, when we say design the characters, because it is just covering 1-3, essentially, these are all the characters that were in those games. And those games were not so much designed as they were simply dressed up. It was just like, what can we do by dressing up some guy and filming him and then doing maybe a few palette swaps after? Yeah. So, the character design is limited in that way. There are some exceptions, Goro and all they did with stop motion animation or whatever. So you get some wackier characters. But even though now, obviously, using this sort of graphic style, it's not going for photorealism, but it's obviously a lot more detailed than sort of Street Fighter 4. Mm-hmm. The character designs are improved, but they're still kind of shackled, they're still anchored to that, you know, origin of them. So it's not, that's not really a strong point. But the point is with the story mode is what it does is it kind of ends up putting you in a lot of different situations with a specific character. So it's a nice way of kind of introducing you to the game's mechanics by, you know, well, now you're gonna, you know, fight this character. So he might use, like, you know, a particular kind of move, so you learn how to beat that kind of player, and then so on and so on. So it has some value from a gameplay point of view, having this kind of scenario playing out in a coherent way. The only thing I would say is they don't really... It's not as good in that respect as it could be, because I think there's some weird, like, difficulty issues. Like, sometimes you have to fight two characters because there is, like, an option to play a tag mode in this, you know, kind of Marvel vs. Capcom style. But in the story mode, there's times where you alone have to fight two characters that could swap out. And these battles are almost literally twice as hard as every other battle, but there's no, like, leavening, like, oh, let's make their damage meter go down more easily or anything. It just any time one of those comes along, it's a big difficulty spike, which is just weird. And the boss encounters are, like, ruthlessly cheap, but the only way to beat them is by being cheaper. So, you know, they are not necessarily great moments either, but for a, you know, one player fighting game situation, obviously it's, you know, it's a bit of an exercise in stringing things out and all that, but it does about as good a job as you could expect with a few little shortcomings in that regard. You've also got, you know, classic arcade mode. You've got a scenario type mode, you know, the challenge tower, which is a bit like the events in Smash Brothers, where you get very specific kind of things that you have to do. And some of them are really wacky, like little mini games. You know, some of them involve, like, throwing your limbs at it just comes up before the fight, like, you can only attack with your limbs, and so, like, you like throw your arms at them and then wait for them to regenerate and throw them again. It's just silly stuff like this, yeah, but so it's kind of throwaway stuff, but again, some of those are kind of taking you through learning different aspects. You'll say, well, now you can only fight him with basic attacks, so it's really forcing you to get to grips with that combo aspect if you want to deal major damage. Or sometimes they just special attacks or throws, or, you know, just emphasize different things, or little status things that'll do to you as well, like changing how much damage is dealt by particular moves and things. So they just mix it up with that, and they, I mean, I think there's like 300 of those, which, having played a bit less than a third, my thought would probably be fewer and more focused challenges would probably have been better.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in general, it's just very, very well done. You know, I mean, you've got the graphics are impressive. It is a rare game that runs in 1080p and what appears to be 60 frames a second.
Wow.
Just came up in an email, of course, a couple of weeks. There is very few games, certainly retail, that run that way. And it looks, you know, impressive for it, especially in the environments. As I said, the characters are kind of, you know. But it also has a stereoscopic 3D mode that I was able to try out. So I don't have a 3D TV, but my family does. So I took the PS3 and hooked it up to that and tried it out. And that was quite impressive. But the one thing I noticed, I don't know whether James experienced this with the Street Fighter on 3DS, but when you're actually fighting, you just focus too much on your characters to really appreciate it a lot of the time.
Yeah, a little bit.
I can see that, yeah.
There is, like, a depth here to the backgrounds, and also, I mean, it's kind of building off something that was always in, especially, like, I think 2 and 3 with Mortal Kombat. Like, they always had that layer of something in the foreground.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they do that again here. Like, so if you're at the bottom of the pit, you've got, like, heads on spikes in front of the, you know, the thing. So maybe some of those things you'll notice. And also they will do certain things, like, say, for instance, when Kung Lao throws his hat at someone, when it ricochets off, it kind of bounces and goes out of the screen and stuff. So there's a few little, you know, showy things. But most of the time, if you're really into it, you'll just kind of forget it's there. Also, the 3D glasses that I was wearing were really... They're just too heavy. Mm-hmm. I couldn't possibly imagine watching something as long as Avatar, for instance.
Which is Infinite.
What brand were they, Greg?
It's a Sony TV.
Sony ones, yeah.
They have their own the active shutter glasses, they have their own proprietary glasses or whatever. It's just, they're really damn heavy. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be necessary for them to be so cumbersome. And
well, they have batteries in them, don't they?
Yeah.
But it's still, it's just like, I can't believe that these are so uncomfortable. I would not want to watch a sporting event that goes on for they have premiership games over here that last a good couple of hours in 3D, and I just couldn't imagine it. Really couldn't. So, I mean, it's kind of was illuminating for me just as to the value of the 3D without glasses on 3DS, to be honest, go through this little experiment. But yeah, I've quite enjoyed Mortal Kombat a little more than I would have necessarily thought. I mean, it wasn't something I was considering at all until the reviews came in, and it's like, oh, this is really quite good. And it's like, oh, well, I like that when I was, I enjoyed playing that with my friends back in the 90s, and I might enjoy, sort of go through it again, and I really have. So it's definitely, not necessarily inspired, but a very, very well executed take on the whole update thing that's very popular at the minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been keeping an eye on it as well, just because I've been hearing so many excellent things about Mortal Kombat, and it seems like, especially with the emphasis on the single player and just the sheer amount of single player content, which was, I mean, the last fighting game I bought was Tatsunoko, and that has virtually
it's
none.
It's bare bones.
Yeah. And I bought Tatsunoko thinking, well, I'll play it online a lot since they added that for the American version, and then, nobody's ever playing it online, and if I do random, then I just get smoked, and it's not fun. So that's why the game didn't last very long in my household.
Yeah, you're just blown away.
Yeah, so I think Mortal Kombat might actually do a little better. I put it on my Gamefly queue because it's like, I was never a huge Mortal Kombat fan, but I did like it at one point. And,
yeah, that's very much the category I'd put myself in. I wasn't big on it, but it was something that I enjoyed playing with friends, and I can enjoy playing with friends now because they know it. Mm-hmm, if I whip out Tatsunoko versus Capcom, they're going to be like, why am I fighting a giant cigarette light?
Right. Why aren't you fighting a giant cigarette lighter?
Whereas if you're fighting some twat with Johnny tattooed across his chest, then, they know who that is.
That's an awesome
Johnny.
Touch.
No, I mean, it's just that sort of touchstone element to it works well. I would like to try it online, but of course.
Yes. Hey, PSN, how you doing?
The PSN. But, I mean, really, I did get it, not necessarily expected to get anything out of the online. Just playing it, with friends locally was kind of the thing for me, which ultimately I would struggle to buy any fighting game without some hope of that being a big part of it, because that really, one player stuff is nice, but it's a little bit of the filler, it's not really good. It's difficult for it to carry its own weight. But when they do get PSN back, me, John, we're gonna have to do this.
Yep.
Maybe I'll throw down with you guys too if I can bump it up the queue.
I've barely ever played any of you at anything online. I think Johnny and
we tried
you
Smash Brothers that one time, and it was not pretty.
Oh, I mean, the thing is with Smash Brothers, it's particularly geographically sensitive, so it didn't really work very well.
It was just
Johnny,
sensitive in general, to be
all
honest.
The way out there in the mountain time zone, and me on good old Greenwich Mean Time, it didn't work that well.
Well, I just remember seeing Yoshi kind of, I saw like static images of Yoshi. He's here, and then he blinks, and then he's over here, and then I'm dead.
It was a total slideshow. Brutal.
It's a Tarantino scene, basically.
Smash Brothers. And we did, Johnny and I played a quick round of Space Invaders Extreme online before.
Did we?
RFM
oh,
once.
Wow. That's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. That's about it. So, we've got to sort this out, John. I want to see your skills.
Well, we'll see. I'll have to practice a little bit. That's for sure.
Greg, we should play some Pixel Junk Shooter 2 when PSN goes back up.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you could do, although you've put me off it a little bit, buying that game in general.
Oh, well, it's a good game. I let me put it this way. I follow Dylan Cuthbert on Twitter, and he retweets a lot of things that people write about it, and most people seem to think it's much better than the first game.
Really? Because I've read quite a lot backing up what you've said. Maybe
really?
Go beyond it.
Send me some links, because I feel a little more validated, because I feel like I made criticisms of that game that I haven't seen anyone else repeat.
I've seen people go beyond what you said in terms of it is less fun than the original.
It's so much harder than the first game, in not a very constructive way, I don't think. But then Dylan pushed back on that. He told me, nah, it's not harder. I'm like, dude, I played the whole game. I think it's harder. He was like a James, your opinion is wrong type comment.
Yeah. You'd expect it to be harder, but I mean, it, you know, it sounds like a kind of step change kind of deal on what was a very relaxingly, pleasantly easy game in the first place. So there's a lot of things I'm looking forward to doing. I'm not even like a heavy user of PSN at all, but it has gone on long enough now that I am beginning to miss it. You know?
It gets ridiculous after a while when it's like been a month and you can't play anything online with the console that you bought to play stuff online with.
Apparently, there's anecdotal evidence from retailers over here that PS3 trade-ins have gone up by like 100% or more because of people coming in. Here's my PS3. Here's my copy of Modern Warfare 2. Give me an Xbox with a copy of Modern Warfare 2.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we're going to have more to say on this and how it might affect Nintendo right on the other side of the break. So why don't we stop for a minute, and we'll do Now Playing. And when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up in impressions, we have Aaron giving us impressions of The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time 3D. The latest entry in Aaron's long-running series of hands-on Zelda impressions includes specifics on the revamped Water Temple, the Mirrored Master Quest, and the brand new Boss Rush Mode. With the game only a month away, this information should help you decide whether or not you want to revisit Hyrule in 3D. We also have an extra life feature. Josh looks at Wario Land Super Mario Land 3, and he revisits this awesome Game Boy platformer, which was Wario's debut as a playable character, which spawned a whole secondary franchise of Wario Land games. Find out whether or not you should be hoping for this game to be launched on 3DS Virtual Console.
It's a Wario Land, but it's also Super Mario Land. Mm-hmm. Discuss.
No, I'm good, actually. Minitroid, 8-bit Chibi Samus for your PC. In this feature, Devin contributes an overview of this very cute, polished fan game, a full-featured Metroid adventure in which Samus is only 10 pixels tall.
It's really cool.
And then we have what you've all been waiting for, a review of another Conduit game.
8.5.
Nice. Not quite.
I'm going to re-review it just to give it an 8.5.
Zach, this time, reviews The Conduit 2 and gives the, quote, full review treatment to High Voltage's sequel. He says there's definitely an improvement to the first game, but you need to read to find out if it's a must-own game.
All right, next we've got impressions of Planetaria. So you've heard Greg's impressions of the Tentai show on last week's podcast and Pull Pull Pulpy on this week's episode. And now you can read Danny's write-up on the first student-made title in Nintendo Game Seminar 2010. He also included an exclusive video for this ethereal DS game. And we have, finally, a review of 9 Hours, 9 Persons, 9 Doors. So you heard about it for weeks here on the podcast, and now you get a different perspective on 999 from Andy Gergen. I wonder what the score could be.
8.5.
Are we on a 1,000-point scale now?
And our last review for this week is Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell 3D. That busy bee, busy little bee. Zach Miller turns in another review, this time taking on Sam Fisher's 3DS debut. Should that be Tom Clancy's Sam Fisher's 3DS debut?
Yes!
It's Zach's first foray into the Splinter Cell series, but he finds serious issues with this Ubisoft launch window title. Unprecedented, surely, James.
Yeah, I know. Go figure.
And finally, we'd like to note here that we are now hiring staff writers in San Francisco and Los Angeles. So we're looking for talented, hardworking writers who want to learn a lot, develop valuable job skills, and help Nintendo World Report become even better than it currently is. There are loads of video game press events in California, so this is your chance to play and write about the hottest new games long before they're released as part of the NWR team.
Who could resist such an opportunity? And actually, that includes going to Nintendo of America in San Francisco and playing Nintendo games before their release, just like Aaron did this week with Zelda.
Yep.
It's a really nice opportunity, and if you think you might be interested, check out the website, find the post on there, and you'll get more information about what to do next. And, of course, You can also find the latest news, rumors, videos, screenshots, etc. A lot of crazy stuff going on with 3DS and, of course, Project Cafe in the run-up to E3. And you really should be checking NintendoWorldReport.com every day for the latest info.
Right now.
All right, we're back for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I'll repeat it again later. John has the first letter.
All right, Loopsu writes, my question today deals with the fact that you guys have been down on Nintendo recently for their lack of immediate online functionality for the 3DS's eShop. In recent weeks, we have seen Sony's online infrastructure taken down by hackers. Have these recent events changed your minds on Nintendo's approach of taking more time to ensure things work properly?
They're taking even more time now than we thought they were.
To do what? I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. They haven't communicated very well about what they're actually doing.
I almost wonder whether it is, you know, because they want to time it close to the E3 presentation, they've almost thought about, well, we'd like to work it in this fashion when they're drawing up the script for the presentation, and they thought, well, you know, it needs to go back a little bit. Let's just have it that close, because otherwise it just seems a little bit odd to bury it that way. You know, if there isn't synergy, you are kind of burying it, which is...
It does seem to be timed for impact.
Yeah, I mean, like, it doesn't...
Here's what we're going to give you, and it's already live. Go update, run. Wait a minute, stay in our press conference.
They are taking kind of a risk there, because what if the launch doesn't go well? Like, did somebody there think about that? Like, what if this...
Maybe that's why it's the night before. They're giving themselves a few hours of
recovery. Yeah, that's worked out in the past. The last time somebody had went and did, hey, it's out now, it was the Sega Saturn.
Yeah.
That's not a good standard by which you should judge your decision making.
Well, here's what I think they're doing. I think that, you know, this we do know that this 3DS update has some kind of 3D video viewing capability. We don't know for sure if the internet browser will be included in this update or if it's going to come out even later.
I think they have confirmed that now subsequently in the press release that went out for Europe anyway, that they mentioned the browser. Yeah.
Okay. But I think that they're probably going to be trying to feed out some of the E3 trailers, at least of 3DS games, if not, you know, clips from the press conference and whatnot. I think they're going to try to deliver that stuff through the 3DS to people, so that you can essentially get it, if not live, then, you know, like at the end of the day, they'll post up all the trailers that they released that day, and you'll be able to browse through that stuff and actually watch it on your 3DS, which is a pretty cool thing, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's Microsoft's done that on Xbox Live the past couple years.
Didn't they live stream their conference 1 year on the Xbox?
I don't know if they did that, but they certainly always have like some kind of E3 hub where you can go and watch all the trailers and learn about the games that they're showing at E3. And I think it's be very cool for Nintendo. I mean, they can do that somewhat with a Nintendo channel.
But
it,
of course, there is more of a sense of it being imperative with 3DS because you actually get to see it in 3D.
Exactly.
But, I mean, to the other portion of... But to the real crux of the question, does the outage of the PSN change my perspective on Nintendo's online functionality? And the answer, of course, is no.
They don't have anything to do with each other, really.
The one thing you could say is that it demonstrates that there's an upside to having to enter your payment information every time.
Yeah. Including the city, state, and county you live in.
It's like somebody on a bike riding by somebody on a car and laughing at them saying, "Hi, your car really sucks, it's broken down." But that person is still riding a bicycle versus driving a car.
I mean, the biggest thing is if Nintendo were to ever, you know, suffer an attack...
What would you steal?
Well, yeah, exactly. This what would be the point? But they could just categorically say, well, there's no way they got your credit card details because we don't even keep them, so...
Yeah.
There is no password. There is no account name. There's no login for Nintendo.
But, I mean, to quote a fake Twitter account for Kaz Hirai, like the PS3, nobody's played the Wii Online for the last 2 weeks. At least for us, it's because our network is broken. The Nintendo's online strategy isn't, essentially. Now, until they show us their new system, which apparently has a much better online strategy, by default, they lose this comparison. Now,
That's not to say that Sony's online strategy hasn't completely effed themselves.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Sony really screwed themselves by pretty much pissing off an entire hacker group and then repeatedly calling that hacker group out so that even more hackers got angry with them.
Well, but, I mean, beyond that, their incident response was really poor, too. I mean...
Absolutely.
It's, I mean, the fact it's been 3 weeks is insane, but... Yeah. The fact that they've predicted dates it was going to come back online like four times now is reached kind of comedy standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, they were caught with their pants down for sure.
Let me just say this. I know this has been discussed a lot on other podcasts, but if you think there is even a remote possibility that your customer's credit card data has been stolen, you'd need to tell your customers immediately.
Yes.
So that they can set up monitoring, so that they can change all their passwords. There's no good explanation for Sony waiting 2 to 3 days before they start advising. And by the way, I mean, I heard about all that even when it was finally, when Sony was finally talking about it, I still heard about it 2 days before they actually sent me an email suggesting that I start changing my passwords. So they were incredibly slow to respond to this situation.
And even at that, the best answer that they can give you is, oh, we believe that no credit card info was compromised.
The way they put it was, they have no reason to believe that it's been compromised, but they can't rule it out. But the thing is about that is you could have said that at the beginning, because that doesn't require any investigation.
That's a non-statement.
That doesn't require any investigation to ascertain that. You could just there's been a breach, we don't know the full extent, but we can't rule this out, so we're telling you now. They could have got out in front of that. They didn't.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing about PSN. It was breached, and then when Sony found out it had been breached, they turned it off. Mm-hmm. So the breach, the hackers didn't turn off PSN.
No.
Sony turned it off. So at the moment that Sony said, we got to pull this offline, they knew they had been breached, and that's when they should have told their customers. Instead, they waited days.
Well, beyond that, though, when they pulled
it... We didn't know why it was down.
When they pulled it off, they didn't tell us why it was down, and in fact, they told us at the time they don't know why it was down.
Well, the PS3 says it's down for maintenance.
Yeah.
Down for maintenance, that's right.
Which is technically true now, but it wasn't when they first did it.
Sony of Europe posted the infamous, an intrusion?
Yeah.
May, you should know, you pulled it down.
I guess the thing that this demonstrates, though, is that when you've got a big online strategy, a big online presence, you have to be prepared for these eventualities. You have to be prepared better than Sony were, which are a colossal company, and they were not adequately prepared for this. So, you know, it does give some insight into why Nintendo have kind of kept things on a smaller scale, perhaps because it's just, they feel like that's something that they can manage, whereas, you know, clearly it's not perhaps as easy as you might think.
Well, as Vic Blatz told us last week, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
So the more connected your system is, the more, you know, the more online your platform becomes, the more responsibility the platform holder has, because you have given them your personal information and your financial
information. There's more doors through which the uninvited can enter.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because we've talked about this in the past, where we've talked about kind of infighting, like hardware versus software within Sony, and it just seems like this kind of factional attitude also extends to their IT department, apparently, because what amazed me was that, you know, after all of this stuff happened, Kat Sarai comes out and says, hey, we're going to make chief online security officer or whatever. We're going to appoint somebody to be that. Really? You didn't have one of those people? You didn't have one person in charge of the online security for your entire company?
What gets me, though, is that their first response was to hire a group of mercenaries to figure out what happened.
Yeah, and outside security.
Their second response was to hire a group of mercenaries to figure out what the first group is looking at. And the third act was to hire another group who oversaw those two groups.
Yeah.
Are they building an IT section on the fly? I mean...
Well, who's scared shitless right now is Microsoft, because Nintendo doesn't need to worry about this kind of intrusion. I mean, I think it affects Nintendo's planning for how they do online things in the future, with maybe upgrades to the 3DS and with the new console.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, they're going to learn a lesson from this. But the current Nintendo online systems, I don't think they're really vulnerable to this type of attack. So I'm not concerned about that. Who's scared shitless is Microsoft, because Microsoft, I mean, Xbox Live is, if anything, more integrated with the system and has more information about you than PlayStation Network does. And Microsoft is, you know, probably better with things like online security than Sony is, yeah. But Microsoft products are infamously insecure. You know, they're infamously vulnerable to attacks like this. So I think they're very, very concerned about this right now, that it could happen to them as well.
The thing is, though, they've also been hated by a hacker community for years.
Right, and they're the biggest target.
Exactly.
It's not that hard to write a virus for a Mac, but why would you bother?
And the same goes with Nintendo.
Right.
Yeah.
You might be able to hack Nintendo's purchase system, but what have you got? You've probably gotten a conduit web service they use to access via encrypted connection to another service, to another service, to a credit card check. It's like, congratulations, you've gotten through 1/8 of the security barriers.
Yeah, and you're a jerk because you hurt Mario. How do you feel now, tough guy?
That's right. Now he's going to be jumping and hitting that block forever.
Yep.
Who's suffering now?
Still, I mean, we're very fond of noting that Nintendo is in many ways a conservative company, so you might still be looking at something where they might say, you know, for the eShop or something, you have to enter your details every time you want to put some money in the wallet or whatever. I mean, I could see them just erring on the side of caution on the basis of this experience.
Well, they could also do something like that because of the situation that Apple's found themselves in with in-app purchases, where parent buys something for their kid, gives their kid the iPhone, and then if like the, what is it, like the next 20 minutes, any purchase goes without having to enter a password or something like that.
Oh yeah, they're gonna that will never happen in a Nintendo situation.
They end up buying $10,000 worth of Smurf berries. I mean, that got them a lot of bad press for a while. I mean, there's a lot of lessons that being behind they get the chance to learn from, but it's a tough place. And while they may get some advantages out of this, they should have already been here. It's so bad.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's gotten to this point. It really is. How am I to trust what their fix to this is going to be?
No, it's the credibility loss is major. It's gonna hurt, and it's also, I mean, it's gonna hurt from a developer point of view. In terms of, you know, all the developers that have lost revenue because they could have expected sales from their games on PSN that haven't got them now.
I mean, if you're an exclusive developer for PSN games, at this point, are you basically ready to tear up that exclusivity license? I mean, now it's almost impossible to say, well, this being exclusive is a good idea.
Yeah, maybe this means more Q games for Nintendo platforms in the future.
More multi-platform games that also show up on the Xbox Live service. I mean, at least if one goes down, the other is still around. You're still going to make some money.
Yeah, you've got to ensure. This is the thing. Were you dealing now with a situation where a revenue stream has stopped altogether?
Right. It's just not there.
The threat of that now raises multi-platform as an insurance, as a hedge against any such problem. And I mean, it's not inconceivable that it could happen to Microsoft and not Sony in the future. So it does probably make multi-platform more desirable.
I mean, if you're currently in a situation where you're not making any money at all, you're probably going to be the first one to make the jump. But I imagine there are people who exclusively develop for XBLA who are saying, we probably can't keep that up. It's probably not safe for us. However, if you exclusively develop for the PSN, you've probably already contacted Microsoft about a development kit.
But it could be an opportunity for Nintendo with the eShop and all that. So, you know, well, if we've got a simple, secure service, you know, maybe there's some things you don't like about it, but it's credible. You know, and if they can increase the usability up to a certain point, then you know, this could be a chance to pick up some of the debris, as it were, that may come out of this disaster.
Yeah, but you gotta back that up with some sales data. You've gotta say, look, people have been releasing this on our platform and they're making money, and I don't really think they can say that for DSiWare.
You can't say for DSiWare, but that's an eShop. What you've gotta do, this is where, you know, how it's handled in E3, I think, is important. And they're having this developer conference, which will be right about the time this episode goes out. They need to present it in such a way that it sounds like something you would like to get in on the ground floor before you could just go with the weight of empirical evidence. And then hopefully that will build a track record that will attract other developers off the basis of that.
Well, actually, James is going to read the next letter, which is on a somewhat related topic.
Travis from Los Angeles writes, with the imminent price drop of the Wii around the corner, I'm seriously considering making the leap and finally picking one up. In addition to the ability to play games like Mario Galaxy and Twilight Princess, the virtual console and streaming Netflix are important selling points for me. Stepping into the game so late, I am worried that the Wii network services might be coming to close soon. I know that they have to keep the network running till after they release the Super Wii. Ugh. But I'm curious how much longer Virtual Console and WiiWare, not to mention the Weather Channel, will be accessible. Do you have any guesses on how much longer Nintendo will keep the network up and running, and how they will go about killing the beast?
Well, first off, if you're primarily concerned about the shops, the good news is that Virtual Console and WiiWare don't do any kind of DRM. They don't check into the service to make sure that you're okay to play this stuff. So as long as you buy the games while the Wii Network services are still being maintained, then you can download whatever you want, and then you'll be able to play it forever. There's no way for Nintendo to disable that remotely or to otherwise keep you from playing it forever. So even if, you know, if you went in there and spent $200 on WiiWare and Virtual Console stuff, you own that stuff essentially. I mean, technically it's a license to play it, but since it's on your system,
it's tied to the console.
Tied to the console, and they don't do any kind of online check to make sure that it's okay for you to play it. So you can enjoy that stuff forever.
So I mean, if you're concerned about that, about it possibly being shut down, you know, buy early, I guess would be the advice. But right. I mean, that's the thing, because as we've said, because they've, you know, it's such a kind of low maintenance approach, you've just got this browser based shop, which doesn't even store the payment details and everything. I mean, I don't see why, especially because it will generate revenue. I mean, yeah, some of the things that have been kept running, like, you know, was it, they kept Halo 2 running on Xbox Live, like, you know, the original Xbox, for years.
Yes. Till last fall.
They made it a big deal, like, when they turned it off, finally, well into the 360's life.
Right.
And that's not making money for them, really. I mean, it maybe encourages some people to go and pick up a copy of the game, you know, afterwards. But really, I mean, you know, that's just a cost. They've already sold the copies of that game, whereas this is, well, that's, I mean, Netflix and the Weather Channel is another thing. But, you know, just in terms of the Wii Shop Channel, the more people have access to that, the more money you're going to make from it. And also, I mean, you have to look, you know, they're cutting the price now. I think they're projecting they want to sell 13 million Wiis this year, you know, and probably that number will that they want to sell will steadily go down. But I think they're still going to look at it as an important plank of their commercial strategy, even after the cafe, the successor,
right,
comes out. Not so much from the point of view of developing games for it, but selling it. Trading off the library of games they've already built up, including these ones that they've, you know, the Nintendo Selects budget range and all that. You know, this is the beginning of that phase of its life. And there's no reason why the Virtual Console and WiiWare don't fit into that phase very well.
No, I mean, agree. It's a web front end, ultimately.
I think the best way of looking at it is there's not a huge reason for them to go about and shut it down anyway. And we're at least a year off from the successor system.
Yep.
So you're going to get at least a year of this stuff. And stuff is still coming out for WiiWare and occasionally Virtual Console.
It's looking up lately.
It is.
So I really cracked me up looking at the Japanese Virtual Console list of recent Super Famicoms that came out. Final Fantasy VI, Rockman X, Chrono Trigger, Rushing Beat Ran.
Rushing Beat Ran.
Is that Rival Turf in Japanese?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I just love the contrast. It was
awesome.
So good.
Awesome.
But no, the Virtual Console, at one point, the decline was such that you did wonder, like, are they just going to kill it? I think it's kind of pulled out of that nosedive now. And obviously just the catalogue that it's built up in itself, which is admittedly smaller in the States than it is in Japan, but still, it's people pick that up for $150. It may be nice if the whole interface, it'd be far more likely to happen if the whole interface was better, but, you know, they pick one up for $150 and they go to that store and they see a bunch of cool old games that maybe they remember playing from their youth or whatever. That is still going to generate sales, and they're not in the business of just depriving themselves of that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question I would send back to Travis, if you're listening to the show right now, is that if you had, let's say, a kiosk on the internet that sold 300 classic video games and it never ran out of stock and it cost you maybe $1,000 a month for upkeep, how long would you keep it open?
I mean, that is the core point that you've raised there, is that, you know, we don't know precisely what the maintenance cost is, but relative to the income, you've got to think it's pretty small.
Yeah.
And so they're going to continue to pay that as long as it's profitable, as long as the income is more.
They will sell Super Mario Brothers on Virtual Console till the end of time.
Yeah.
Because they can.
I mean, as far as Netflix goes, what's involved in that?
Well, nothing. On Nintendo's end, nothing. Right. Nothing's involved with it. They host the Netflix app on the WiiWare store, but after you download the Netflix app onto your Wii, it doesn't go through their servers at all. It's just like, I can watch Netflix on my PlayStation 3 right now, and I do, even though PSN is down, because you don't actually have to be logged into PSN to watch Netflix. It goes straight to the Netflix server. So as long as Netflix exists and you're subscribed and you have that, if you already have the app, you'll be able to watch it forever.
Yep, it's just like watching it on your iPhone. 10 years from now, you'll still be able to watch it on your iPhone.
Well, and there's a good reason for that, because Netflix has made an active campaign of getting the Netflix app on every fucking device they can.
But also, it's not gated by the platform holders.
Yeah.
When you log into Netflix on the Wii, you're logging into Netflix and nothing else. So they control that.
But I mean, it's not likely that they're going to say, okay, we're not going to allow the Wii to access anymore, because it's been their objective to be on everything.
Oh, tons of people watch Netflix through the Wii.
Oh yeah, it's a huge market. And like I joke at one point, I have a bunch of devices on my entertainment system and an uncountable number of them can connect to Netflix.
All right. The next letter is from Chris in Chicago. And he writes, I got a 3DS at launch, and the only launch game I purchased was Super Street Fighter 4 3D. The next game I'll be purchasing is Ocarina of Time 3D in late June. At first I thought having only one game for 2 months would be torture, but so far I'm loving it. I'm taking the time to plumb the depths of this game, and I'm trying to become proficient with several different characters. I realize that I haven't spent this much time with one title since I was a child. I have been saddened by how many people are whining that they have already, quote, finished all of the launch 3DS titles and are now bored with the system. When I was a child, I played each game I owned until I knew them inside and out. I can't remember a time when I felt I was done with NES or Super NES games. At some point, gamers switched from savoring games to devouring them and discarding them. Why do you think this shift in attitude occurred? My theory is that by including achievement systems or checklists in games like the Star System in Pilotwings Resort, developers have given gamers the impression that they have experienced everything possible in a game and thus have no reason to replay it. Or is it simply that the volume of games has increased dramatically? Or is there something else about modern game design that discourages replay?
Well,
I'd say none of the above. You're just older.
Yeah.
I think age is a big part of it, definitely. People get older, there's more demands on their time, but they also have disposable income.
Mm-hmm.
You put the two together, the individual games will sort of get a smaller slice of the pie.
Mm-hmm. The phenomenon's not over. I mean, there are people who've put hundreds, maybe thousands of hours into Call of Duty Black Ops in the span of 6 months.
Yeah.
That's not any different than you know, when I used to play whatever on my NES until there was literally nothing I had not seen in it. It's the same thing.
That's the whole thing. I mean, when you're a kid, I mean, your parents, really a lot of it comes down to money, because when you're a kid, you know, your parents are buying your games for you, and they're not going to sit there and buy you a game a week.
Or even if you are mowing the grass and saving up your own money, you have enough for one game, so you choose very wisely, and then you appreciate it much more because that's all you have. It's just
especially if you own an N64.
If you eat one meal a day, it will taste really good.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, in real terms, games just cost a lot more back then.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for me with import games, you know. Mm-hmm. So I played games to death. I mean, it's the only way that I would, you know, really that you'd be able to complete things like Super R-Type and Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I mean, this hasn't gone away completely. If there's games I really, really like, I will play them until they are exhausted. You know, something like Galaxy 2 getting 240 stars in that or whatever it is. The Sin of Punishment 2, I've done the hard and played that for score and all. I mean, if there's something I really, really enjoy, I will still just crush it until there's absolutely nothing left. But it is relatively compared to the past, because there's so many attractive alternatives. I mean, for instance, you know, with the issue of the 3DS games, I mean, yes, it might be true that there's not that many games for 3DS. You know, I've had Pilotwings, and a friend let me copy Ridge Racer. I played that a bit. But there's plenty of other games on other formats.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, I mean, I have played Pilotwings to death, but it's not as if I was only playing that. So that's just kind of a little curious about Chris's letter. Is like, did he not play any console games?
I kind of agree with what you with your point there. I'm kind of curious if there is a certain amount of design that's moved towards making games more disposable.
Look, the design has moved because right. the average age of a gamer is older, and so a lot of the people that buy games are these people have more demands on their time and stuff, and they have more options because, as Chris notes, is one of the possibilities for it. The market is bigger. There are more games.
And more game consoles. And yeah, more portables.
More formats, more portables, more everything. So, you know, game designers has to reflect those market realities of, you know, there are a lot of people who, if they're presented with a certain kind of game design, are just going to say, you know, I don't need this. This isn't worth my time. Especially with the trade-in phenomenon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you didn't necessarily gamefly it like Johnny does, where you could put it back in the envelope as soon as you grow tired of it, you could still just take it back to GameStop or whatever.
Yeah, there are a lot more options now for just the way games are distributed and how they're available to consumers.
Well,
I mean, when I was a kid, we saved up penny. We literally rolled pennies and quarters and bought Rampage for NES, my sister and I. And we played that game to death, and it's repetitive as hell, and there's not that much yeah. actual content. It's just repeated over and over.
Yeah.
But we played a ton of it because it was, I mean, think of what we went through to, you know, mm-hmm. we spent months gathering up spare change to buy this crappy NES port of Rampage.
Yeah.
We played the shit out of it. You know, I don't have to do that anymore, so I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, so what I would say is that those kind of underlying forces of the games market getting bigger, games players becoming more numerous, older, higher income, you know, more independent, those are the real fundamental drivers. But game design has evolved with it, and then that just reinforces it. And,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. so that then gamers that's the games that they start playing, that's what gaming is to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, though, that, I mean, you have to remember that gamers now are more skilled, so they are better at consuming content.
In many cases, yeah, you have a point, because we've learned more. Like, we have yeah. now the collected, evolved knowledge of gaming for the past 30 years that when I was a kid, you know, there's a lot less of that. I didn't understand nearly as much. Part of it is because I was younger, but even people who are my age now, back in the 80s, didn't know as much about video games as I do now, because there weren't as many video games in existence, and they hadn't played as many. They hadn't grown up with them as much as I have now.
And think about how complex the games are that a kid would start out with now.
Mm-hmm.
Much more complex than me playing friggin' Tank Combat, Atari Combat on the 2600 with a joystick and a button.
But then a lot of kids now are growing up on Angry Birds, so it's not necessarily
yeah.
true.
Yeah, it doesn't have, but there is that kind of content out there.
They may
be exposed to very complex games from an early age.
It's also telling that Chris, the game that Chris has been devouring for 2 months is Street Fighter, because that is a game that, I mean, certainly Super Street Fighter, it's at least the third version of that game in the past 3 years. So they've had a lot of time to refine it. They've added a lot of content to it since the original release of Street Fighter 4 for the consoles and in the arcade. Even the console versions had stuff that the arcade didn't, and then they've done Super, and now they've done 3D. So they've added tons. There's a lot of content in that game, but also it's not a point A to point B linear beat this game type of game. It's the kind of game that's basically a rule set and a bunch of characters, and you kind of create your own miniature games out of that by combining different elements of it. I mean, it's the same reason that we played hundreds of hours of Smash Brothers, you know. So I think that is just a kind of game that if you're... Now, I wouldn't play Super Street Fighter 4 3D for more than 5 hours. I'd get sick of it because I don't like fighting games that much. But if you love that kind of a game, you know, our guy in Japan, Matt, he was talking about the same thing. He said, I've just been playing Street Fighter endlessly on my 3DS because he loves that kind of a thing, and it's the kind of game that really doesn't play itself out. It's not really to be consumed. It's not like this adventure that's been designed by this group of people, and you play through it, and then the only other thing to do is to play through it again. And, you know, I think what you'll find, Chris, is when you end up with Ocarina of Time 3D, you'll play it once, and then you might play the Master Quest, although personally, I find the Master Quest is really tedious because even though the dungeons are slightly different, the story's all the same, and you can't really skip through it. So if you already know the story and you've already done that stuff and you just want to get to the parts that are different from the last time you played it, it's really kind of, I don't know, just takes forever. I lost patience with it the last time I tried it. But, you know, at most, you're going to play through that game twice, which is about 40 hours each time. And then, are you going to play through it a third time? I mean, what's the point? What did you really miss the first couple times? Probably not that much. And you've probably played through it a bunch of times before. So, it's a very different kind of game than Street Fighter, and I think you'll find that it is more disposable because of that. Not to say that it's short or that it is particularly disposable, but relative to something like Street Fighter, a Zelda game is far more disposable, and it always has been, even back to the very first one.
With those sorts of things, I mean, it's just got to click with you, you know, to a point where those like little nuances, you know, whether it would be in the fighting system or something like Street Fighter, or just the amusing qualities of something like Smash Brothers, or the intricacies of the level design and the score system in something like Sin and Punishment, that those matter to you.
Yeah, or Geometry Wars.
Yeah, Geometry Wars, you know, so these games still exist. You know, I mean, even though, as I said, I think game design has changed to some extent, there's still plenty.
Pokemon.
We've
talked plenty about how people do that in Pokemon, you know?
Take things to different levels, so.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about that kind of game design that sort of reveals itself over time going away.
Okay, very interesting topic. Greg has the next letter.
Shaman from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia writes, "We all know that recently Nintendo has been trying to become gaming's answer to Disney, with the focus on family-friendly entertainment and local multiplayer. However, Disney has Touchstone Pictures and used to have Miramax under their purview to release more quote-unquote mature or R-rated content. Compare this to Nintendo, who, according to a quick ESRB search, haven't released an M-rated retail game since 2005. Which was Geist. A lot of quote-unquote hardcore gamers have basically given up on Nintendo for their lack of dude bro factor. Could you see any value for Nintendo in creating a second publishing label to handle mature or otherwise niche content? Ideally, they would have the full rights of Nintendo first party, including access to the marketing budget / Club Nintendo, but marketed separately in a way that may actually appeal to the people who bought COD Blops. Examples of games that might be released under this label could be the twin JRPGs of Xenoblade Chronicles and Last Story, the lamented Zangeki no Regulus, and perhaps most importantly for getting the brand off the ground, the next Metroid game."
Yeah, and none of those are dude bro type games, so I think it's a little bit of mixed messaging in Shaman's question.
I guess
here,
that's the otherwise niche part, JRPGs and things.
Right.
I mean, I guess this would be the sort of flip side of Touch Generations.
Yes,
right.
I think it's a great idea, actually.
Yeah, I think it is too.
They had that branding there with Touch Generations, you know, for a good number of years across two different platforms, so it was quite a broad thing, but it seemed to be successful. But of course, it also dovetailed very well to Nintendo's general approach.
Right.
You know, yes, they singled out certain games to be under the Touch Generations umbrella, but it was very much mainstream for what Nintendo was doing. This is a little different. This is like the side brand, if you will. So it could be difficult to establish well, but they've expressed the fact that they've kind of struggled in some of these areas, you know, with marketing certain games. They certainly said that the other M did not sell as well as they would have liked, and that they think it should have sold better. So perhaps that reflects somewhat on their marketing. It's worth considering.
Well, you know, in Japan, they do this sort of. They have the black box Wii games.
The black box goes for C-rated or above, which they have actually published a number of already.
Right. Zangeki no Regulus.
That is one. Pandora's Tower will be another.
Yeah, that game sounds twisted, to be honest.
It's a very odd game. It looks a lot like Castlevania Lords of Shadow.
That's not a bad thing.
Except there's no part about forcing a vegetarian to eat demon souls or demon flesh in Lords of Shadow.
Presumably no Patrick Stewart in the Pandora's Tower, unless they really crank up the localization budget for when they...
There are three lights, by the way.
So, the black box thing, that actually applies to all Wii games that are released that are of a certain rating. So, Mad World is a black box game, No More Heroes 2, all this kind of stuff. But Nintendo have released games in that range as well.
Fatal Frame 4.
Yeah, that predates the black box era, but it would have gone in. And presumably that new Fatal Frame that they're doing in Japan, which is like a remake of the second one or something.
Oh, I haven't heard of this.
There's another Fatal Frame coming out for Wii, presumably it won't come out anywhere else, that will be a black box game. Right. So I mean, Nintendo's certainly not allergic to this in Japan.
Right. I mean, ostensibly they're saying the black box is there. Oh, just be careful. This game is for adults. But
it's not like other Wii games. Like, it's basically like,
it's a marketing gimmick.
Yeah.
But it's an insurance against the sort of erroneous but nonetheless widespread kind of perception that develops. It's like, oh, it's a Wii game, so it must be family-friendly because all Wii games are family-friendly, right? Well, you know, the fact that that's a fallacy doesn't mean that it doesn't inform a lot of people's expectations.
Sure, and it serves the dual purpose of the old hip-hop albums that put the giant parental warning label on the cover because it was like, ooh, this...
Yeah, they sell more because of it.
Yeah, I mean... It's kind of a shrewd marketing move for them.
Well, I'd really just like to see them call it Nintendo Bro.
I'm not sure there's all that much bro-y about Pandora's
Tower.
That'd
be great in the black box.
I mean, the nice thing about Shaman's idea is that it involves Nintendo publishing games that they ostensibly would have published anyway. I mean, it's not a matter of them, you know, going out and trying to get distribution rights for some kind of Grand Theft Auto thing. It's not like that. It's not about them changing who they are or the kinds of games they put out. And the thing is, Nintendo has been putting out games like this, especially in Japan. And I think largely due to marketing reasons and market forces, it's more difficult for them to release some of that stuff in America, or they're, because of the added cost of localization, because they weren't originally developed in English, the American branch has a higher hurdle to cross to actually make their money back by releasing a game over here.
Right.
So I think having a different way to market it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, Reggie's background is in doing stuff like that. So
yeah, branding.
It seems feasible that this could actually happen.
One of the things that I think, if you were going to do this, it would have to be an investment. Mm-hmm. You would have to be prepared, perhaps, to publish a certain number of games in America under this fledgling brand that may or may not be economic propositions in themselves.
Right.
But it's part of building the brand, getting a bit of cachet going. And the question is whether NCL would be of a mind to approve such a strategy.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you could make each game an event, right? You could say, oh, the next game that we've picked from Japan for this brand is da-da-da-da.
Right. You'd have to hand them something big, like Last Story, early.
Yeah, you've got to build it. You've got to be very careful about how you build it. Because, again, they might be loosely affiliated in some ways. But, I suppose it's happened in certain cases where you've had these publishers bringing things over from Japan that were kind of unlikely, like working designs. You know, I mean, they were bringing over games from all different developers and stuff. But I'm sure there was a certain amount of identification. Just like, you know, it's something that they're bringing over. So it's got this kind of, you know, Japan-only kind of cool thing to it. So, I mean, it's certainly not beyond the realms of possibility. And, of course, Nintendo has the kind of the money, the financial muscle to try and make it work. But as I say, the problem with it is it's not an obvious, like, you know, cause and effect. We put this much money in, we get this much money out.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, and it seems like NCL is more given to that kind of thinking.
You know, I mean, Nintendo has a long history of sub-brands with Player's Choice, and now they've got Nintendo Selects and Touch Generations, and even games with Wii in the title is almost like its own sub-brand, and they've been very successful with that. So
yeah,
I think
it's a good point.
There's plenty of proof that this kind of approach works. I think for these kinds of games, it would also be, I think this would work best if Nintendo actually hired basically a separate marketing department for these games, because what you've seen is that when they have brought over these games, like, not that they brought over Metroid Prime 3, but when they have published games like that, when they brought over Metroid Other M and a few other things, the people who are so good at marketing other stuff like Mario Kart Wii and, you know, Wii Sports Resort and stuff like that, they don't seem to know what to do with these games. They don't understand them. They end up trying to sell these to the same market of people who bought all the other Wii games, and it hasn't worked. So I think it would really do them a lot of good to hire people who are really focused on this kind of game and can do the PR and the advertising and the marketing for this kind of game and not be held down by the standards and practices.
Right.
You know, I mean, having the We Want to Play guys selling Metroid Prime is a bad idea. it was a bad idea. It worked very poorly for them. And even predating all this Wii stuff, I mean, Nintendo didn't know how to market Metroid Prime 2. I know it came out the same day as Halo 2, and that was a big problem, but it wasn't marketed well either. They did have a really cool commercial, but I don't think they were showing it to the right people. And I think a TV commercial isn't really a very good way to market a game like Metroid Prime 2, which is incredibly complex and deep. So they need people who understand these games better to sell them without having to worry about the way Nintendo usually does it.
It's interesting because Iwata singled this out, sort of, when the recent investors meeting, where he said, well, we should have brought in more outside marketing for Wii.
Right.
Which, you know, on the surface of it, you might find quite curious. It's like, wasn't the Wii marketing masterful? Wasn't this one of your greatest achievements? But perhaps this is more the sort of thing that he's talking about for certain kinds of software. But I think that you've seen with the Wii, you know, it's been a very unique time because it's got to such a point, you know, it's so diverse. Just what's on Wii in general, and particularly what Nintendo's publishing. What you've got to remember is, you know, if you go back to the Super Nintendo days, you look at how many games they were publishing in a year, it was not very many at all.
No.
It was a handful.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, games were not as diverse then. They were in very sort of very specific genre pigeonholes. That was such a different challenge from what you have now. So I think specialized marketing to go along with that is a very nice idea.
All right. Well, John has the final letter.
Okay, Remy writes, I work in the gaming department of Best Buy, and allow me to clarify. Yes, I am a girl, and yes, I do actually know shit about games, contrary to popular belief. The most common question I get while in my department is, can you find someone to help me out with insert console games? Anyways, my first question is about Wii games. When I sell a Wii, I often encourage the purchase of an extra Wiimote and Nunchuck, as the purchaser will more than likely want to have more than one person playing with them. People normally don't have a problem buying a second Wiimote, but are often reluctant to buy an extra Nunchuck and ask how much they will really need it. It's always a tough question for me to answer, so I thought I would defer to you fine gentlemen. How many Wii games need a Nunchuck to play?
The one that's in the box.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say. Whether it's Wii Sports, Wii Sport Resort, or now Mario Kart Wii, all of those games support the Nunchuck. And for instance, even with Mario Kart, if you buy a second Wii remote and not a wheel, and I don't even know if they still sell wheels separately, it might be hard to find, then you would probably want a Nunchuck to play for the second player on Mario Kart Wii.
I'm sure you probably could. I mean,
there's plenty of wheels out there.
ExciteBots is fine without a wheel. I'm sure the motion controls are fine without the panto element of it. I mean, it's a weird question, this one, because there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. First of all, the question is about a second Nunchuck. So we're talking multiplayer games, really. What do they? How many multiplayer games need a Nunchuck? I suppose if we're going to say need, a lot of them don't.
Yeah.
Let's break it down by category. You've got your party games, right? Wii Party, Mario Party.
Party.
Need it. Boom Blocks, you can use it, like it helps with camera control and stuff, but you don't need it. If you're going to do any of the co-op side-scroller stuff, so New Super Mario Bros., Kirby, DK, you don't need it. Again, DK supports it, but you know it's not necessary. If you're going to do multiplayer FPS, like split-screen, you don't have to have it because you might use classic controller instead. You know, one person could go Wii Remote and Nunchuck, one person could go classic controller.
If this person's not sure about whether they need a Nunchuck, they're not buying a classic controller.
I'll just say, for instance, if they bought a classic controller for themselves, they could then use that for the second player and not have to buy two classic controllers or two Nunchucks.
It's true.
So, and then if you talk Mario Kart, you can just use the remote on its own. Or the classic controller again. If you're talking Brawl, that supports a Wii remote-only control scheme. Pretty much everything that's multiplayer has some sort of other option.
Yeah.
Except boxing and Wii Sports.
So it's surprisingly few that it's absolutely essential for. I mean, I think Mario Strikers Charged would definitely be one that it's essential for. I think Sports Mix as well, there is an alternative in that. So I don't think you could really say, well, you absolutely need a second Nunchuck for this, this, and this. It's not true.
If you're getting a game like Smash Brothers, then
yeah, you need it. Unless you're going to buy something like the classic controller.
Right. I mean, what a lot of the examples Greg put out there, it's true you don't absolutely need it, but the game is much better if you have a nunchuck. And,
I would,
and that's what I would tell people. It depends on the games that they plan to play.
I would tell them, you don't have to buy it now. You could probably get by without it, but eventually you're going to buy this.
Mm-hmm.
Because probably. It's true. If they begin to gain any value from the Wii system they've just purchased, eventually they're going to end up coming back for that nunchuck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I mean, some games just play better with it, so...
I don't know about you guys, I play Mario Kart with a nunchuck.
Yeah, I definitely like the nunchuck scheme best. Yeah. That's the case you'd have to make, is just that, well, you know, there's a lot of two-player games that are going to be enhanced with the nunchuck, and also, it might be easier from the point of view that if you're using Wii Remote and nunchuck, it's going to be easier to show your friend how to play if they've got the same thing, you know, yeah. if they've never played that kind of game before.
Oh, and it's more fair. I mean, it...
Yeah.
I used to make my...
Brawl with the Wii Remote only, that sounds a bit unfair.
I used to make my friends play Wii Remote and Nunchuck Brawl while I had Classic Controller, because I was like, ha-ha, screw you guys. But it's my system, I brought it. Guess what?
See, I like playing Brawl with a Classic, but usually the people I play with always want the GameCube controllers, so it busts out Wavebirds.
But, you know, I would say find out what games they're buying, really, is probably
the
best.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a tough... If they're really interested mostly in the party games, like Wii Party...
WarioWare.
Carnival games.
Yeah, then it's kind of a tough sell.
But if they're buying, like, GoldenEye, yeah, they need it.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really, that's what it comes down to. Look at what they're buying. And I trust that she can look at the game and say, well, that's probably going to be better or worse with it.
Right.
I think, you know, she was kind of hoping that we'd be able to give her, like, numbers, unfortunately.
But it's like, it's most of the games, the big Wii games that absolutely need a nunchuck are single player. You know,
that's true.
They're Mario Galaxy, you know, like Metroid Prime. That's where they are. They're in the single player arena, and you already got one nunchuck, so.
Right. I'm going to say, though, it really is shameful that the nunchuck isn't included with the Wii Remote. I mean, honestly, yeah. How much does the nunchuck really cost them to make?
Well, nothing. The reason they did it is so they can sell it separately.
I know. That's why it's shameful.
They're nickel and diamond.
It's a shameful revenue squeeze.
Right.
Yep. I had that backwards. They sell it separately so they can sell it for more.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words... People would go crazy if the combo was priced at $60.
And that's
but instead, it's $40 and $20, and that's, in people's minds, that's different. And it is, it gives you the option, at least, but I just don't know that it's a very useful option.
Yeah, it's still shameful.
A lot of the third-party things you buy actually do have both together.
Yeah, they do. In fact,
the third-party controllers. Some of them are pretty good.
With the exception of that Nyko one that felt the need to sell them separately.
The wand. Yeah, the
Nintendo
wand.
Nintendo style.
The wand's kind of weird, but I like the Power-A, the mini controllers. I think those are good.
I mean, another angle you could look at maybe is sports games. You know, like I think Madden. I'm not sure if they've ever had an alternative to Wii Remote and Nunchuck. I mean, some sports games they have, like Pro Evo started out, that was just Wii Remote and Nunchuck, but they've got Classic in there now, I think, down the line. I'm not sure that Madden's ever done that, but...
Yeah, I've played Madden at E3 now enough times that you want to play it with the Nunchuck.
I mean, Super Sluggers requires it, I believe, and that's in the select
slot. I'm pretty sure that's got a Wii Remote on. It's probably gimped, but...
It's probably awful.
Huh.
But yeah, I mean, in the case of the EA Sports games, I think I played two that didn't require the nunchuck, and one was bad, and one was, like, I think I wanted to hit Nick with the remote, because that was pretty much the only way I could have derived any fun from it at that moment.
Wii Play has the tank game. I think you need a nunchuck, don't you?
Right, and then, of course, there's the upcoming Wii Play Plus.
Wii Play Motion. We don't know what that's going to be all about.
No.
But, you know, that game is sounding more interesting now that they've said it's like this weird... they say all the mini-games were designed by experienced people. I don't know if they were within Nintendo or some of the third
appear
party.
They appear to be outsiders.
So is there like the Hideo Kojima Motion Plus minigame in there?
Like... It's like the Smash Brothers soundtrack, but with games. No, it's not quite.
That's intriguing, you know?
Well, my understanding is that these were concepts that were all developed inside Nintendo, but their actual development to a point where they're in this Wii Motion game, you know, they're being fleshed out, has been done from outside.
So they just outsourced minigames. That's weird.
Yeah,
that's really weird.
And then let the other team put their twist on the idea.
Yeah, so I don't intriguing, yes. Whether it will become an attractive product is a bit different.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for writing in. We have, I have to say, the past few weeks we've had spectacularly good emails, and really we've had a number that were quite good and totally worthy of being read on the show and discussed, and we just have too many. We can't do them all. So, I mean, I think we're getting to the point where we're hitting that critical mass, and I just have to let people know we read every email that we get, but we may not be able to read it on the show and talk about it on the podcast because we just get too many good ones. So thank you very much, and I hope you'll continue to do that. And if you send in what you think is a good question and we don't get to it, send it again a little bit later, or modify it, or just send in a new question. It's not because we don't like you.
Or send it directly to John. It'll never get read ever. The email black hole known as John Lindemann.
we have our listeners really are amazing and very intelligent, and I thank you all for participating in the show, because clearly we love to do this part of the show, and it's a very big part of RFN. So thanks very much for sending the emails. The address once again is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, or you can go to the article on the website, and I'm putting the contact form in there, so there's a little link and you can just type it directly in there and we get it just as well. So, of course, you can also listen to our sister podcast, The Newscast, which is coming out usually on Saturdays, so the day before this one. We've got Radio Trivia every few weeks, and you know, TYP was on last week and he mentioned that show with Zach Miller, but that's out now and it's really good. So definitely listen to that if you haven't already. TYP is actually going to be here in Colorado next week, so he's planning to do this podcast with us next week. He'll be back on, but this time sitting next to me, and we might see if we have time to record a Radio Trivia while he's out here. Hopefully we can do that. And finally, we should announce the winner of Retroactive, and it's going to be Perfect Dark. So thanks to everybody who voted. It was the clear winner, although actually Beyond Good and Evil got a lot of votes, and at one point looked like it might be catching up and could possibly overtake Perfect Dark. Not much love for Prince of Persia in there, and I wonder if it's because the remake is seen to not really add very much to it, or if maybe people just haven't, you know, not enough people have played The Sands of Time. I mean, this game was in our Game of the Decade discussion. So
I would say Sands of Time had more players than Beyond Good and Evil. It was a bigger success than that.
It doesn't have that cult status though, does it?
Well, that's because there were like three sequels in 4 years. I mean, yeah.
And I think a lot of people, you know, clearly have become acquainted with the Prince of Persia series after The Sands of Time, and maybe some of those people haven't actually played the original game, but it is really, really good. So, you know, it's out of consideration by far from Retroactive. I think it got one or two votes. But if you haven't played Sands of Time, you should get around to doing that at some point. It is quite an amazing game and very influential over a lot of things that are out now. So it's really interesting to go back and look at it as well. Anyway, let's say probably not next week. We might do an E3 preview next week, but probably the week after that we will start discussing Perfect Dark. So we'll be playing it in the interim, and I hope you will as well. Again, the original N64 version's not that hard to find, so if you have a working N64, you can definitely pick up that cartridge, or like Greg, just pull it out of the closet.
Yep. Already sampled a little bit of it, actually.
Nice. How long has it been since you played, Greg?
Oh, well, I've dug it out for multiplayer in the, you know, at times during the last decade, you know, mm-hmm. but single player have not touched that since the summer of 2000.
Wow. Well, we'll be talking about both sides of the game. I assume the other three of us will be playing it on 360.
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, multiplayer for me is who turned on that slowdown. Stop it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to re-up my Xbox Live Gold so I can actually pop some caps in y'all ass.
Bussing caps in y'all ass, Johnny.
I have the original, but it's in an attic somewhere. So
yeah.
It's been a long time since I played Perfect Dark, and I'm actually I'm looking forward to it. And it was a very popular choice in the poll, so hopefully a lot of you are also interested in revisiting Perfect Dark. A very ambitious and in some ways overlooked game from 2000. It came out at a bad time for an N64 game to come out. Let's put it that way. It was, I think it was a May release, which is not a great at that time, that was a pretty unusual time of the year to release a big game like that. And the N64, a lot of the audience had kind of moved on already.
It was a delayed title too, wasn't it? I mean, it's a rare game on an N64. It was a delayed title, but I mean,
very, very delayed.
Delayed by rare standards.
Very much so. But it is a fascinating game, and I'm looking forward to seeing the remake because, let's say, it pushed the N64 too hard in some ways. So it'd be interesting to see how it feels playing it at a smooth frame rate.
Expansion pack. I don't need your expansion pack. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for voting. I hope you will continue on and participate in the discussion. You can go to the site. I'll kick up a forum thread by the time this episode goes out. And you can start posting away your thoughts as you play through the game or just reminisce upon it from your past experiences. It'll be a fun discussion, I think. All right. That's the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back next week with another exciting episode of Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Peace out, bitches.
Densha Dego.
That's my next import title.
I've seen a copy of that in my scouring for old Japanese games.
And you didn't buy it?
No, I didn't buy it. You could just buy the controller for 35 quid.
The controller.
It's the train thing, isn't it? You know, so yeah, it's got like these little lever on it and everything. It's awesome.
I need to control the train.
I wonder if it's compatible with the Steel Battalion controller.
I encountered what I consider to be the definitive name for a fishing game.
Fish on?
Bass Rush.
Isn't that the one that's got like the completely insane cover to it?
I could only look at the name.
There's one where there's like fish like leaping over the boat and a guy trying to catch them, and there's like other
catch him in his teeth.
It's just chaos.